So tonight is part four in our Old Testament study of the book of Amos, and we are coming to chapter two, three and four tonight. So if you have a Bible, I'll reference some scriptures out of those two chapters. We've been looking at this outline that was in your previous handout, and the last two chapters, one and two, were prophecies against the nations. And we said that it was kind of like a bullseye, all these nations surrounding the nation of Israel. And finally, they come to the centerpiece of the bullseye. And that brings us to the next major section of the book of Amos in chapters 3 through 5, verse 17. All those prophecies, all that information is now centered on the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes to the north. And we're going to take a look at chapters 3 and 4 tonight. And the two big points in this outline is now God is going to reveal his judgment upon his own people for being unrepentant for their sins and their extravagance. And so that's where we begin tonight in this particular chapter, which is one that begins as a context again to a specific amount of time between 760 and 750 BCE, where there was some prosperity and peace that was going on, and so we find here that in spite of the fact that externally they were calm, were not in a battle during this period of time. They were relatively safe, but they allowed their spiritual corruption to continue, and that then brought about Amos's predictions that there would be a foreign enemy that would come in and take them captive. But the way this begins is very important because it begins with a reminder of the uniqueness of the relationship that God had with the nation of Israel. And it's the idea of a covenant. If you look at verses 1 and 2, it says, "Hear this word, people of Israel. The word of the Lord has spoken against you, against the whole family I brought up out of Egypt." So the context is, I delivered you, you're my chosen people. And then it says in verse 2, "You only have I chosen of all the families of the earth." So behind that is the idea of entering into a special relationship. And that special relationship has a technical term of a covenant, entering into an agreement that God would be their God and they would be his people. And one word that is used for that is the idea of election. You get in the New Testament, there's a little bit misunderstanding, I think, of the idea of election when it comes to Calvinism and predestination and choosing specific people to go to heaven and other people don't get to go to heaven. And that's not the idea here at all. Israel's election is this idea of being chosen as a group of people that can become the salt and light of the nations around them, which is the idea of privilege, but it is also the idea of responsibility, that they have a certain responsibility to live up to this. Well, by the time you get to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 14, the Mosaic covenant has been specified to King David, and the Davidic covenant is this idea that there would be a Davidic king, and God would be the God of this chosen people. And part of the imagery that is used for that is the idea of a chosen princess or a chosen bride. I'm going to read a couple of verses out of Ezekiel chapter 16 because it kind of expresses the type of relationship God was looking for with his people. It says here in Ezekiel chapter 16, it says in verse 8, "Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you." That should bring back the imagery of Ruth when Boaz and Ruth are getting engaged to be married. It says, I covered your naked body and I gave you the solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. Now, this is using ancient Near Eastern imagery, obviously, choosing a bride. The bride becomes the possession of the man. But that's beside the point. It's this idea of entering into a special relationship. When you go on down in Ezekiel chapter 16, it says, you became very beautiful and rose to be a queen in verse 13. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because the splendor I had given you made your beauty perfect, declares the sovereign Lord. In other words, she stood pristine above the other nations. And then all of a sudden it takes a turn. And this gives explanation for what we're looking at in Amos. In verse 15, it says, but you trusted in your beauty. And you used your fame to become a prostitute. You lavished your favors on anyone who passed by, and your beauty became his. You took some of your garments to make gaudy high places where you carried on your prostitution. Now, I think part of what's going on here, what began with Solomon was looking to alliances with foreign nations, and many of his wives and concubines were foreign relationships that allowed him to have that international power, but along with that came the idea of the gods that these foreign people brought with them and the wives and so forth. And so that's where the prostitution imagery comes into play. So let's go back to Amos now. And in Amos, here we begin to see a divine indictment and of their privilege. And the way it is done is there's a series of rhetorical questions that are used to illustrate kind of the inevitability of God's coming justice. And what we find is Amos shifts from oracles against the nations to specifically Israel. And they're in covenant violation. And as a result of that, they will experience the judgment that God is going to bring upon them, which is the idea of a foreign nation coming in and disciplining them for wandering. So these verses serve in a very profound way to announce ahead of time, before it happens, that there is a coming judgment. And God is going to enact this action based upon the plans that he has revealed to his prophets. It says in verse 2, you only have I chosen of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your sins. And then he begins what we will call rhetorical questions. These are questions that are not necessarily to be answered, but they are to enforce certain things about what is about to happen. So the way the first eight verses of chapter 3 go is election has responsibility. Election is this idea, I chose you, but you are to carry out this privilege with responsibility. Then in verses 3 through 8, and I'll detail the rhetorical questions in a moment, but they're based kind of on cause and effect. So look for that when I read them in a moment. And then in verse 8, it's interesting, the imagery of the lion that begins really in verse 4. Does a lion roar in the thicket when it has no prey? It begins using that imagery of a lion. And then you get to verse 8, it says, the lion has roared, who will not fear? And then it says, the sovereign Lord has spoken, who can but prophesy? So the lion here in verse 8 is God. It's the imagery of God. God is roaring out here for the misdeeds against the covenant. Now let's come to these rhetorical questions. So You begin in verse 3, and you'll see these questions are stated here, and then there's a cause and an effect, and there's a kind of an implication in the imagery. So it begins here. Do two walk together unless they have agreed to do so? So here's this idea of we agreed to this relationship, this covenant relationship. And there is this prior agreement or relationship for companionship to continue. And God's presence in their land implies this agreement. So if we were to turn to Exodus 20 and read the Mount Sinai account again, you would find that it's there they agree to do all that God had commanded. Then we find in the next rhetorical question, does a lion roar in the thicket when it has no prey? The idea of cause and effect here is that the lion roars because it has found its prey, it's found its kill. And God's roar is through the prophet signaling, I have found the prey of a bride who has gone astray, adulterous, that type of thing. Third rhetorical question. Does it growl in its den when it has caught nothing? And the implied idea here is the growl confirms the catch before they start eating what they have caught. And so all of these are warnings that are giving to us this idea, listen, God is serious about this. Turn from your ways and come back to me as your God. Don't follow after these other false gods. Rhetorical question number four. Does a bird swoop down to a trap on the ground when there is no bait there? Well, the idea is, what's going to attract a bird to come down to a trap? Well, there is this idea something has attracted it to come down and the trap is set. And so there's something that has provoked all of this. Well, behind this is this idea of false gods, false altars, which we'll come to here in a little bit, the false altars that were set up in various places to worship these other gods. The next one. Does a trap spring up from the earth when there is nothing to catch? In other words, see, same idea as the previous verse, right? The trap is set when there is a bait there that brings that particular animal to the trap. So the trap here is sin. Sin has caused these people to be attracted to these other gods. They go for it, and now that trap is about to be set. Then it says, when a trumpet sounds in a city, do not the people tremble? So here's this idea. A trumpet was used for warning, right? And so if you hear the trumpet, sort of like a fire alarm in a building, okay? When you hear it, you go, uh-oh, we got to get out of the building. It's that idea. And then lastly, it says here, when a disaster comes to a city, has not the Lord caused it? So here is this idea of moving toward this last rhetorical question. And it's this idea, God has been provoked, and this has caused him to bring discipline upon his people. So in these, you're going to come over to chapter 4 for a moment, and it has some of the similar ideas. This time, though, it is a five-fold refrain that talks about, you did not return to me. Now, that's why I put this slide here. Because of the rhetorical questions are implying the answer that judgment is deserved, then in chapter 4, and that's why I'm linking these two chapters together, shows what's going to come. You did not return to me. You did not return to me. You did not return to me. And the five things that are mentioned in chapter 4 is here's what's coming: famine, drought, blight and mildew, plague and warfare, and then finally an earthquake. Now we'll come to that in a moment when we get into chapter 4, but I wanted you to see The rhetorical question set up this refrain. You didn't return to me. You had the chance. You didn't return to me. You had your chance. You didn't return to me. So that then begins this fivefold step. Okay, so you come to verse 9, which I already read, but it's part of verses 9 through 12. And this is a judgment that is going to be witnessed by other nations. Now, this is quite ironic here. Let's read it first. The lion has roared. Who will not fear? The sovereign Lord has spoken. Who can but prophesy? Proclaim to the fortresses of Ashdod and to the fortresses of Egypt. Assemble yourselves on the mountains of Samaria. See the great unrest within her and the oppression among her people. They do not know how to do right, declares the Lord, who store up in their fortresses what they have plundered and looted. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says: an enemy will overrun your land, pull down your strongholds, and plunder your fortresses. So let's stop there. Now, here's what's very interesting. It's as if God is calling upon the foreign nations to witness as a trial goes on for God's chosen people. So position yourself, Ashdod, foreign, Egypt, foreign, assemble yourselves on the mountains of Samaria and observe what goes on. You are the witnesses to this. So the prophet here is talking about two pagan connections, Ashdod and Egypt, as character witnesses that what is coming upon Israel is deserved. Okay. Israel is indicted for two things here. Number one is violence, and number two is injustice. And you find here that in verse 10, it says they store up in their fortresses what they have plundered and looted. In other words, they went to war and they took all of this. And then it talks also about the oppression among the people that's causing unrest in the land in verse 9. So this great unrest is a result of injustice and the violence that is used amongst neighboring nations and plundering their resources. Then you come to verse 12, and you have this image that is kind of hard to get our arms around. It says, as a shepherd rescues from the lion's mouth only two leg bones or a piece of an ear. So it's already been eaten by its prey, okay? So will the Israelites living in Samaria be rescued with only the head of a bed and a piece of of fabric from a couch. Now, what that's talking about is when Assyria comes in, it's going to look a lot like Palestine right now. And there's no play, there's not much left over. There's a piece of an ear there, and there's two leg bones there, and there's only the head of the bed, not the full bed, and there's only a little bit of fabric to cover with. In other words, it's been decimated, okay? And so when Assyria comes in, it's going to decimate Samaria. And those that are living in Samaria, a few of them might be rescued, but the majority of them are not. Most of them are going to go into exile. And the imagery of a shepherd may be to kind of show what happens when a wild beast kills part of the flock. And maybe some commentators have suggested that maybe the idea here is that a shepherd would take that ear or take those two leg bones back to the owner of the flock to show what happened, the decimation that came upon his livestock. So this is the idea here that there will be a little bit of a remnant that's going to be left behind in Samaria, but most people will be taken captive into Assyria. Okay. Then you come down to these false places of worship.
illegitimate altars. And in verse 13 through 15, which finishes the chapter, it says, "Hear this and testify against the descendants of Jacob, declares the Lord God Almighty. On the day I punish Israel for her sins, I will destroy the altars of Bethel. The horns of the altar will be cut off and fall to the ground. I will tear down the winter house along with the summer house. The houses adorned with ivory will be destroyed, and mansions will be demolished," declares the Lord. So, two things are going on here in these verses. Now, again, hear, testify, witness this. But then it says, "On the day I punish Israel for her sins, I will destroy the altars of Bethel." Now, most scholars think that this is when Jeroboam built the golden calf set upon the false altars in 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 25 through 33. So this is an illegitimate altar. It's a false altar that's worshiping a false god. And of course, you find that this is a repeated theme throughout the story of Israel as well as the prophets. But here's an interesting thing. The imagery here is fascinating. I will destroy the altars of Bethel. The horns of the altar will be cut off. What is that referring to? The horns of the altar on the four sides of the altar were these horns that kept the sacrifice in place. Okay? And ancient history also said that this was also a place of asylum for people that are running from violence. So they could run to the place where there's an altar, and as they reached the horns of the altar, they were considered, sort of like in the Old Testament says, the cities of refuge, where there's a place of protection. So scholars suggest that the horns of the altar here not only serve the physical need to keep an animal in place for the sacrifice, but it's the place where a person could find legal asylum from those that are bent on murdering them. And these horns are cut off. In other words, there's not going to be a safe place anymore for people to run to. So I hope that makes sense. Okay. Okay. Then it talks about the winter and summer homes here. Now, here's what's fascinating, and it kind of shows a little bit of the prestige and the prosperity that was going on during the time. So, winter and summer homes, ivory houses, critiques of those that are living luxuriously versus those that are trying to find their next meal. Okay, this big gap between the rich and the poor and the destitute. Well, here's a fascinating thing. There is a thing called the Samaria Ivories. I've never heard of this before until this popped up in my research. It's a series of excavations that took place between 1908 and 1935. And it unearthed over 12,000 ivory pieces in ancient Israel in Samaria. So they literally took the ivory of elephants to make all kinds of mementos and false gods and that type of thing. Most think that this happened during the reign of King Ahab, between 870 and 850 BCE. But its material was elephant ivory. Some of it, they believe, was imported from Africa and India. All kinds of things were made out of it, plaques and furniture and cosmetic boxes and so forth. And there were motifs as well, the deities, sphinxes, lions, lotus flowers, that type of thing. So the biblical connection might be 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 39. And so I'm going to read that real quick. There's no proof on this, but it's a fascinating archaeological discovery. So in 1 Kings chapter 22, you have this period of time. So if you kind of want to get a feel for the evil that was going on through the reign of many of the kings, here's a good way of remembering it. In the north, you had no good kings. All of them were bad. All of them were idolatrous. In the south, you had mostly evil kings, but you had a few kings that were good and that led revival and so on. So in 1 Kings chapter 22, it says this, as soon as I get there, verse 39. Where am I at? As for the other events of Ahab's reign, including all he did, the palace he built and adorned with ivory, and the cities he fortified, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? So the palace and so forth. So if you want to do an internet search, you'll find you'll find artifacts sort of like this here, where it's all made out of ivory, over 12,000 pieces of those type of things, and that might be what Amos is referring to here in chapter 3 when he says that all these houses adorned with ivory are going to be destroyed. And so where do you find this? You'll find some of the pieces in the British museums. You'll find some of the pieces as well in what, where were some other places? Can't remember now. Anyways, I know Britain has some of them, but I'm not sure. There's a few other places that hold some of these pieces as well. Okay, so that's chapter 3. Do you have some comments or questions for chapter 3? So it begins with rhetorical questions, anticipating the answers in chapter 4. So this does have some implications, I think. When we think about election, the idea of God choosing certain people to represent him, there's this idea of obligation as well, this idea of holding high the position to which you've been called. Prophecy is not optional for the true prophet. It has this compulsive nature to it. The prophet could have easily ran away from this, like Jonah tried to run away from his calling. But Amos steps into it, and it's not a popular message by any means. As you'll see in chapter 4, he's got some choice names for some people. And then finally, God calls even the enemy nations to kind of serve as witnesses to what's going to happen to his chosen people. Okay, so now we come to chapter 4. And in chapter 4, you have this idea of judgment that's coming because no matter how many prophets God sent, they just did not choose to turn from their idolatry and their false gods. So this is another kind of oracle found in the word here in verse 1. Hear this word, another oracle that's directed toward Israel's elite, okay? The elite group that has been leading the people away. And you'll find satire, you'll find a little bit of lament in this chapter as well. But the thing that will jump out at you here is verse 1. Okay, this is great. He says, "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan and Mount Samaria." Well, who are they? "You women who oppress the poor and crush the needy and say to your husbands, bring us some drinks." Okay, this is the Real Housewives of Bashan. Okay, that's what this is. People that are used to luxury, used to the best, heaven forbid that they have something that doesn't meet their standards, that type of thing. It's a condemnation. It's a very biting metaphor for indulgent women who are the ones that are enjoying all of this luxury. And it then talks about how they're going to be led away. And boy, the imagery goes on in verse 2. The sovereign Lord has sworn by his holiness, the time will surely come when you will be taken away with hooks, the last of you with fish hooks. God is the great fisherman that's going to snag them and reel them in, basically. You will each go out, will each go straight out through breaches in the wall, and you will be cast out toward Harmon, declares the Lord. So here we find this idea of the wealthy cows of Bashan. And in this fertile region of Mesopotamia, cows could be well fed because of the lush pastures. And so it became one of those images that stuck. You know, when somebody is overindulgent, overfed, and stuff, they're like these cows that have all the lush type of field to eat from. And it's a very caustic and sarcastic insult toward these people who don't care anything about but what how they look and what they own and who's going to serve them, that type of thing. So he's not commentating necessarily on physical indulgence, but the whole package. That is their physical indulgence, their spiritual waywardness, and their social irresponsibility to help take care of other people. So he's speaking to the wealthy women in the capital city of Northern Kingdom of Israel and what will happen as a result. So verses 1 through 3, very biting and sarcastic. Then it goes into verse 4, and it's almost like an invitation to go worship. Look, it says, go to Bethel and sin, go to Gilgal and sin yet more. Two alternate places where people worship these altars at Bethel and Gilgal. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 years, burn leavened bread as a thank offering, and brag about your free will offering. Boast about them, you Israelites, for this is what you love to do, declares the sovereign Lord. See, they are taking advantage of all of their wealth, but they're going through the religious motions. They're offering the sacrifices. See what a good person I am. Well, now he said, no, you go worship at those false altars. Don't come into Jerusalem. Don't go there. You go to these false altars because you're worshiping someone that is not the true God. So, having said that, then he gets into this refrain that I mentioned to you a moment ago. And they all are underlined with this phrase, you have not returned to me. That's verse 6. You have not returned to me, verse 8. You have not returned to me, verse 9. You have not returned to me, verse 10. You've not returned to me, verse 11. So you have this fivefold refrain, you did not return to me. And as a result, there are going to be some successive judgments that are going to be brought about. And so when you read them, you then see what they are, okay? Number one, verse 6, I gave you empty stomachs in every city and lack of bread in every town, yet you have not returned to me. This is the idea of famine, okay? It's this idea that they did not have enough food to eat. There's famine that they had run into. Then it goes on, it says in verse 7, I also withheld rain from you when the harvest was still 3 months away. I sent rain on one town and withheld it from another. One field had rain and another none and dried up. So there's drought, okay? One is famine, second is drought. People staggered from town to town for water. but did not get enough to drink, yet you have not returned to me. In other words, you just, nothing's changing your heart. Nothing is softening you toward God. Then, next, he says in verse 9, many times I struck your gardens and vineyards, destroying them with blight and mildew. So their vineyards are diseased. Okay? Blight and mildew. Locusts devoured your fig and olive trees, yet you have not returned to me. So pestilence as well that is affecting their crops. Then number 4 is verse 10. I sent plagues among you as I did to Egypt. I killed your young men with the sword, along with your captured horses. So they experienced defeat in battle. I filled your nostrils with the stench of your camps, implying disease and plague that comes from death. Yet you have not returned to me. So very, very powerful and over the top type of statements of what God allowed to happen, and they had not chose to turn. Then finally, verse 11, I overthrew some of you as I overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. You were like a burning stick snatched from the fire, yet you have not returned to me. So there's a reference there to Sodom and Gomorrah. Fire rained down upon Sodom and Gomorrah. Was it a volcanic eruption? Was it caused by an earthquake? What, there's a lot of debate about that. But it's interesting what the connection is here. As Sodom and Gomorrah, cease to exist, you're going to cease to exist as well. And that's actually what happened. The 10 northern tribes never came back to the land. The two tribes of the south eventually made it back after a number of years of captivity in Babylon. But you remember on Sunday morning, I talked a little bit about the diaspora. Sumerians were part of that diaspora that people scattered and then intermarried with other non-Jewish people and so forth. So a lot of this is kind of couched in specific language. What's hard is to determine what the specific points are historically. That's what's tough. When did this happen? Where did it happen? That type of thing. So then you kind of come to this climactic threat. It says in verse 12, therefore, this is what I will do to you, Israel, and because I will do this to you, O Israel, prepare to meet your God. Okay? In other words, this is no longer are we husband and wife. Now we are relating on a different level. And then finally, there's kind of a doxology to the power of God here. He who formed the mountains, who creates the winds, who reveals his thoughts to mankind, who turns dark dawn to darkness and treads on the heights of the earth. The Lord Almighty is his name. So verse 13 is sort of like a doxology. God is sovereign. God is powerful. God reigns over creation. All of these things are a reminder that if what God is warning you of does not change your heart, it's going to happen. It's not if, but when. Does that make sense to everybody? So let me close off and we'll see if you have some things you want to talk about tonight with some additional theological connections here. External religion without righteousness is an abomination before God. They were keeping a lot of the sacrifices. Number two, God disciplines for the purpose of repentance. You did not return to me. You did not return to me. God didn't want to pour all this out upon his people, but they would not return to him. Number three, divine sarcasm exposes the hypocrisy and false piety of those who were still claiming that they were God's people, they were God's elect. Number four, there's a link between Israel's idolatry and their exploitation of the poor. And I think it's couched in that vivid metaphor, the cows of Bashan. And then number five, the judgment of God is irrevocable and cannot be delayed indefinitely. Now, what's tough about this and is how do you apply this to our day and age? We did not enter into a covenant with God on Mount Sinai, okay? How much of this is applicable not only to our own country, but to the countries around the world? So here's a way of bringing the two chapters together. So there's a chart in your notes there. Chapter three, election brings accountability through rhetorical questions. The enemies serve as witnesses. There's judgment on palaces and altars. Then you have that shepherd's remnants, the ear and the broken bones that are brought back to the owner. And then the lion roars, and when you hear a lion roar, it catches your notice. Okay. Then chapter four, religion's hypocritical. You have some sarcastic comments about the cows of Bashan. You have internal corruption. You have judgment on their worship and upon the Real Housewives of Bashan. And there, it's pictured as hooks in the nose, kind of like a fisherman being brought into bringing a fish into shore. Prepare to meet your God. So maybe that chart is a good way of bringing both chapters together, and allows you to get a 60,000 foot perspective on the two chapters as you look on, down on it. So I want to close with some discussion, and let's ask these questions. So we have freedom to discuss. I'll pause the recording, but let me read the questions here. How does privilege blind us to judgment? Number one, where do we see false worship today, and how do we respond to divine discipline? So let me pause the recording and see if you have some thoughts on any of these things.